This is SiriusXM Doctor Radio.
From the heart of the NYU Langone Medical Center, here is psychiatrist Dr. Michael Aronoff.
Welcome to the Psychiatry Show. Thanks for joining me in our discussions about the human psyche and the challenges offered by human behavior, those of others and those of our own, too. We are live every Tuesday from noon to 2, that's Eastern Time, here on SiriusXM 110. And we talk about all sorts of issues, about why people do what they do, why people do what they do to us, and for that matter, why we do other things to other people and what we can do about it. We try to put our heads together, and we invite you to join the discussion. Our number is 1-877-698-3627. That's 1-877-NYU-DOCS. And as I say many, many times, we are not interested necessarily in identifying you. If you are somewhat self-conscious about that, we don't have to have your name. We don't even have to know where you're coming from. We're interested in what the issues are, whether we can put our heads together and come up with some solutions to it. So you can also call us with, you know, some other name or some other place that you're calling from, or you can email us at docs@siriusxm.com with a comment, with a question, with an observation. Now, let me ask you something. How sensitive is the issue of sexual harassment these days? And also, when was Bill Clinton impeached? Well, he is still being asked about Monica Lewinsky. And with the birth of the Me Too movement, scrutiny of misconduct in office is greater than ever. And also what's greater than ever is the tone-deaf response of the harassers, or for that matter, the reluctance of the harassed to speak up. And it's there for everyone to see, if they choose to. Now, it's interesting that the ex-president, that is Clinton, is on a book tour with his co-author, James Patterson, and he said that he doesn't owe Monica Lewinsky an apology. This, he says, in the Me Too era. Well, let's talk about harassment in the workplace, in social settings, in the classroom, even in the hospital or research laboratory. So I turn to my guest and friend here in the studio, Davia Temin. She is the chief executive of Temin & Company, a New York management consultancy that helps corporations create, enhance, and save their reputations with a focus on marketing and media strategy, reputation, and crisis management. Davia, thank you so much for joining me again. Great to see you, and happy birthday as well.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here. I can't think of a better way to celebrate it.
Well, there may be better ways, but this is one of the good ways of celebrating, right. That's for sure. Now, you are a spokesperson for major organizations during crises, coach numerous global CEOs, you're a frequent and very popular public speaker, and you advise worldwide corporations. We're going to talk about harassment in the spectrum of which it operates, both from the point of view of corporations, of course, what they can do about it, and from the victims of that. And,
Absolutely.
How did you get into this field specifically? Let me just mention again the phone number, 1-877-698-3627. That's our phone. If you want to join the conversation, talk with Dave. You have a question about either something you've experienced, something you've observed, what to do under these very difficult social settings where we're put at some disadvantage or potentially put at some disadvantage, 1-877-NYU-DOC. So, how did you get into this?
Well, it's very interesting. There are a couple of different parts of how I got into it. The first one was when I was right out of college, I got a master's in psychology. And for the practicum for that, I actually was a rape counselor in a counseling center in Manhattan, the Women's Counseling Project. Mm. And I later became the chair of the board of that counseling center. So we served 8,000 women a year and on all kinds of issues, but a large percentage of them, of course, were sexual abuse or rape. So I got to do that for quite a while, and that was formative. And then many, many years go by. I work in the corporate world. I then start my own company 21 years ago to do reputation, crisis management, and leadership coaching. And that really is what I do now, also for countries and for individuals, sort of you name it. I'm a fixer.
Well, So, as a fixer, what would your response be? What would you say to Clinton when you hear him saying, "I don't owe Monica Lewinsky an apology"? What do you think of his response, that he doesn't owe her one? And what would you advise him to say instead?
Yeah, very tone deaf and sadly tone deaf. I do say that there is a difference between a consensual relationship between two people and a non-consensual relationship. However, that gets muddied, as we know, through power and abuse of power. If someone is the president and somebody's an intern, that changes the power.
We need to spell that out a little bit, because I know exactly what you're saying. But let's spell that out a little bit, that there are ways, subtle ways, in which power is exercised. And it is it really hamstrings people's responses in one way or another. If you are dependent on your boss, for instance, for an income, and you need that, how free are you necessarily? And you must run into this all the time. How free are you to say, "No, don't do that. I don't agree," or whatever?
Well, it's not just your income, it's also your career, because you saw that with Anita Hill as well, and many, many, many people. This is more the norm in many instances than it is the exception. So these are normal things that you see.
By normal, you mean... frequent. You don't mean normal.
Thank you, Dr. Aronoff. Yes, that's exactly what I mean. Frequent.
Right.
Highly frequent.
Right.
So what I've always found is that the way that has worked for me, primarily, and for a lot of people who I know who have worked in primarily male environments, is humor. And humor for me always worked. I would spell out my boundaries in no uncertain terms, but I'd do it in a funny way. I would do it with humor. I would try to do it that way.
Do you have an example that comes to mind? I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot that, you know.
Somebody puts their hand
where it doesn't belong,
and you say, "Whoa, no way, Jose! This is only I do that, or somebody who I invite in, or husbands only, or whatever it is." But I make the delineation.
It's very interesting, because what you do by saying it that way is you are being assertive. You are not shrinking violet.
No.
You're not deflecting. You're not staying aside. You are saying, "Hold on, buddy." You know, and you're making yourself, it sounds to me like you make yourself on a co-equal level. The playing field has just been leveled.
The power dynamic. But on the other hand, I don't do it with, or at least I didn't do it with anger. Because then that turns it into something else. I did it with humor, and I do it with humor when you can. Now, you can't always do that, of course, but when you can, the humor, because you're going to have to continue to work with this person.
That's
generally
true.
Right?
That's true. Yep.
So if you do it with a lightheartedness, no way, Jose, bye-bye, that's not in our cards, or something like that, that's better. And I have found that works very well. That works...
depending on who it's working
that's
with.
Right. Yeah. Now, I don't think that's going to work with a Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to work with a true aggressor or rapist or whatever else.
A predator,
right.
Okay. Let's go right to the phones. Bruce from New York. Bruce, you're on the air. You have a thought, a comment, a question?
I do, sir. At a previous life, I was a supervisor at a large call center in New York City. And we would have, like, young female employees coming to work dressed, for want of a better term, provocatively, whether it be wearing Spanx, halter tops, and then coming to me feeling offended that their male colleagues were staring at them. And by the same token, my bosses would come to me, ask, "Why is this particular employee dressed that way?" And I felt very uncomfortable approaching the young lady. I'll be perfectly honest. I was scared to approach them.
Because
of the potential of an allegation that I was, harassing them. Or if I didn't acknowledge their complaints, that I wasn't obviously being sensitive to it. And the solution I had, and it was not one that I was comfortable with, was that I would have a female colleague come with me. But I don't feel that that's a fair position to put me in, that I would, have to do something like that.
Very interesting, Bruce. Very interesting.
And a real problem and a real issue that lots of guys feel, because
We were talking before we went on the air about, you know, guys have said to me, well, what am I supposed to do if I see somebody I'm attracted to? How do I know whether to come on to her or not? Or, what's the situation here?
Well, first of all, those are two different things. So
yes.
What I think that what Bruce is asking about is he's being put in a very awkward position. First of all, I counsel. I mean, nobody in my office wears things like that because, these are provocative. And they're teasing, and I think it's inappropriate to wear that kind of stuff to the workplace. I don't care what kind of workplace you have, that's not the appropriate attire to wear, and it does put you in an awkward position. And I think we have to acknowledge that, right? So,
absolutely, I think we have to acknowledge that there's a biology, there's an evolutionary biology at work here. There are differences in the psyche of men and women, but that doesn't excuse behavior that crosses certain boundaries.
No, and I think these are two, they can be mutually exclusive. He's not saying that he acted inappropriately. He's worried about being perceived as being appropriately. That's two different things. And yet he's also being held accountable for the young women's attire by bosses saying, why are they done? So I think what you have to do is create a dress code. And you have to have a dress code that is widely acknowledged, and that means no leotards, no things that are too low cut, too high cut, too whatever the case might be. And then I do think, though, Bruce, reality being what it is very hard for you as a guy to deliver that message. It may not be fair, but I think you have to have a female accompany you, or in fact, not just accompany you, deputize somebody to do that. And you're not in that room where they're saying, because I certainly say it to people, I say it to people I coach as well as to people who are in my firm, it's not appropriate to wear to the office. Mm-hmm. You can't wear that. You can't wear that and get the kind of respect that you want to get as an employee, as an intellect, as a human being. Not here. Don't do it.
Bruce, how did you respond when you were put essentially in the middle of two very realistic concerns, but they're opposite each other in terms of their intent? How did you respond?
Well, again, my solution was, unfortunately, I had that solution for me. And by the way, we did have a dress code because I brought a female counterpart with me.
Good.
And but by the same token, it was the police department, and I felt that my whatever perceived authority was being sort of undermined by having to resort to that, if I'm making any sense?
Yeah, you are, but you know what? It's not, because it wasn't undermined at all. We're in this cultural shift of so many different aspects where, I mean, you got to know that a lot of guys are inappropriate, right? Not you, but you've probably seen it in your work at different points. You've probably seen women be treated in ways you wouldn't want your daughter to be treated, right? I'm assuming? Ever seen that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Right. So we're in this shift where that, which has been unacceptable forever but not been talked about, is now being broached. So there's a cultural shift there. Then there's also this cultural shift where gals are wearing things that, you know, I would previously wear only to work out in a gym. So, and they're wearing them on the street. So all of this is coming at the same time. There aren't going to be perfect answers as we sort of sort this out culturally. But that doesn't mean we can't figure out ways to do it. And I think you don't want to put yourself in the position of being the enforcer in that regard. Far wiser to put somebody else in that position, to deputize them. You're still deputizing them, but have them in that position, I would say to you.
Well, Bruce, there's another, maybe I'm saying the same sort of thing in a different way, and that is you're put in a position where there are two opposing but significant and important points of view. And what is wrong with, or maybe, Davey, I'm interested in your thoughts about this too, saying that, look, two things have been brought to my attention. I think we need to have a program in place that takes into account both of them and make it sort of semi institutional, that is, and shift the responsibility from Bruce's shoulders to the company itself, which broadens the purview of the company and makes them in a better position.
Yeah, but he's saying there is a dress code, and you just then have to enforce it. and somebody has to do that. And that is something that, for whether it's fair or not fair, you just don't want to put a good guy in that position right now. And this is all coming, this is all glommed together, coming to a head, and we have to chart a fair course. And that's fair for good guys, as well as for the women who have been treated reprehensibly.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, where do things stand with you? You're still not in that same position, I take it. Is that correct?
Well, yes, and it nearly came to a head, and fortunately it didn't. I was somehow magically able to avoid it. Because one of the young ladies dressed inappropriately came to me to complain that her male colleagues were staring at her. And my gut reaction would have been, well, you know, you're kind of violating the dress code by dressing this way, when she probably would have made a harassment complaint against me. And, you know, things being what they are, it would have been...
So you know what, Bruce? I don't know that she would have done that. I mean, you know, I really don't. Because I think guys are now so scared about so much that they're not sorting out what is real to be scared of, frankly, and what isn't. So and again, I think it's hard for a guy as a supervisor to do this, but it would be helpful if you had a human resources person who was a woman to help do you that.
Just to muddy the waters a little bit, right. That kind of statement, that kind of example that you gave, Bruce, it could be interpreted by a lot of guys saying, well, look, she's asking for it, number one. And number two, maybe she is in some way. Maybe there's some sort of unresolved problem. But, you know, we're not going to solve that problem today. Bruce, I want to thank you for the call. Our number is 1-877-698-3627. That's 1-877-NYU-DOCS. We are talking about harassment. We're talking about sexual harassment in this day of the Me Too era. Here on the Psychiatry Show, I'm Dr. Michael Aronoff, and my guest here in the studio, my guest and friend, is Davia Temin. She is the chief executive of Temin & Company, a crisis management, marketing, and media strategy company here in New York City. Davia, I think we got to go back to the phones. Okay.
Can I say one thing before we do it?
You can say many things.
So I want to tell you the one thing. Harassment training, sexual harassment training, has been proven actually not to work very well at all. In fact, they've done one study where they found out that people who take sexual harassment training are more liable to blame the victim than if they hadn't taken it.
Why is that?
Well, I can't tell you that, but what I can tell you is what does work.
Okay.
All right? The one thing that they found that does work time and time again is bystander training. We see it in terrorism. See something, say something. If that means that if you're Bruce or if you're any other guy in the workplace or anywhere else, you see something happening to a gal, a woman, that you wouldn't want happening to your daughter or whatever else, that you actually act. You instead of turning away, you're empowered to act.
I'm thinking in this day and age, we could use some additional bystander training elsewhere, like, for instance, in our government.
Yeah.
It would be very helpful. Let's go back to the phones. Yeah. Let's go to, who do we have here? Donna from Michigan. Donna, you're on the air.
I'm calling related to I kind of have a very difficult situation. I have a daughter that's 33 that drinks a lot and probably is an alcoholic. Who was married, and then my husband, who is her stepfather. There'd been some drinking together, some socializing together between my daughter and her husband and my husband. I never really thought too much about it. Some behaviors started getting suspicious, and then I recently was told, like a couple months ago, that my daughter told me that my husband had molested her. And at this point, I wonder if you ever get an answer from the person that has done the bad thing, my husband. Do they ever come out and say that they've done it?
Well, I'll tell you, Donna, first of all, I'm sorry to hear this complex, terrible situation that must be really gut-wrenching for you. I want to bring it in the context of what we're talking about harassment and these tricky relationships between men and women, between women and men, between men and men and women and women. This can happen at any level. We do need to talk about power differential and so forth. I think that what your example is a little bit different. There's crossing of boundaries here, and there is not a respect for the boundaries between relationships that is further fueled by the substance use, the alcohol use, which just softens any kind of boundaries whatsoever. If you're asking for whether people admit to wrongdoing, look, we all know the answer to that. Most people don't initially. Most people deflect. We see examples of that all the time in the news these days about it being projected onto someone else, about claiming someone. Look, quite frankly, just to come back to Clinton, because I saw this interview on television, that he started, when he was confronted with the question, he started blaming JFK and LBJ, you know, all previous presidents. And he also got in a shot Trump. Funny that his name escapes me for a moment. But in any case, this is a terrible situation that really needs to have some sort of intervention, and is almost on the not just on the purpose of professional intervention, but this is almost on the basis of some sort of illegality in terms of stepping on other people's toes and so forth. What have you done about this, Donna? Not that there is anything that's easy for you to do, but...
The police were informed the night of the incident. He had left, and my daughter did call the police and made a claim. But she was drunk at the time and was drinking even more after the incident. So I don't know how well they took that, or how, you know, whether they thought the claim was worth it at all. In fact, she did kind of follow up, and they said, you know, it would be hard to prove and hard to hold him responsible.
There's something much more going on than just holding somebody responsible for this. Everybody's responsible, or, you know, there's some sort of mix of responsibilities here that need to be sorted out. So the question is, what handle do you have to try to begin this? And one of the things that you have is, it led to your daughter, drunk or not, to call the police. What does she want to do about her life and where it's going right now? I'm not asking you for an answer. I'm suggesting that this is the tack to pursue at this point, because I don't know what the answer is at this point.
You're right.
So I'm not saying this to be right. I'm saying this to get you mobilized to do something. Now, let's talk about what you can do about that. And I think that what you have to do is, you got to call the riot act on your daughter at this point. It's gone far enough. If she's the one of this triumvirate or whoever is involved, if she's the only one that you have some sort of leverage with, you've got to use that as much as you can. Because, I can hear it in your voice. We're concerned about this, but you've got to do something about it. And the only leverage you have, at least at this point, is an exploratory one with her and say, enough already. You got to do something about it. So,
right.
What are you going to do?
I'm
putting it to you.
I need to confront her. I need to confront the drinking. I need to confront the lifestyle.
Absolutely. And now let me just add one additional thing. I think you absolutely do need to confront this. And then in response, whatever she says is, what do you want me to do? You're laying this out in front of me. What do you want my response to be? And if she says, well, I want help, or I don't want help, it's beyond you alone to handle this. You need to get some additional help to support that. So this.
What type?
Well, you know what? If nothing else, you know, there's an organization called Al-Anon. You ought to go there because that's for families who are involved with, you know, problematic behaviors of one sort or another. This is just a very complicated interaction. But that's a place to go where there are other people who have wrestled with this kind of thing. You put your heads together and you come up with at least some clarifying suggestions at this point. This right now, I'm not trying to make it worse for you, this right now is a mess. And you got to start sorting it out. And I know you know that because you're calling about this.
Right. And, you know, as far as sorting it out, my husband has not admitted to it, but behaviors pointed the direction where he was attracted to her. And so I have filed for divorce.
Yes.
And I have never
Good for you. Good for you.
Yeah,
good for you.
So
yeah.
so let's talk a little bit with my guest here in the studio, Davia Temin, who is a crisis manager in this kind of, you know, without talking about the specific psychological issues that are involved, just systems. What should she be doing? We're in a similar mind, I'm thinking.
I think we are. I think that the first thing that you want to do is get away from the problem. So as much as you can so that it doesn't happen again, right? So you've got to be able to think. You have to get yourself and your daughter in as much safety as you can. So with this man, I mean, I don't know how you can look at him in the same way ever again. And by what it says, you can't. So what it says to me is that you have a lot of courage because you filed for divorce and you have confronted this in your own mind. You're going down that journey of confronting it. In a crisis, Donna, what I say is the first thing that you need to do is deny denial. When something bad happens, when something bad happens, the first thing that all of us, whether you're a chairman of a board or a CEO or an individual like us, the first thing you do is say, this can't be happening. And if it is happening, it's not that bad. And it's not happening to us. Or nobody will notice. Or it'll get better. We don't have to do anything. You know, you go down this whole scale of denial. And it takes a real amount of courage to be able to deny that denial, put it away, short circuit it, and face what's going on so you can start to take solution steps. And by filing for divorce, that is what you've done. That's one thing, right? So you've already started to go down that course.
Right.
The second is to keep him away from your daughter or your daughter away from him as best you can. Are you living in the same place?
No, my daughter is married and lives at the location where the incident happened. And I'm still with him because he won't leave the house.
Oh.
Mm. Well, step by step, you got to start peeling away some of these problems, like peeling an onion one layer at a time. It takes some time to do this. But the fact is that your daughter is living her life and is shooting herself in the foot at the same time. There's a limit to how much you can do specifically living her life for her, but you can start to set certain boundaries about what's acceptable and not acceptable, and you've done that in terms of your own life. That in itself has some value because it's setting a model.
Yeah.
So I think that that's what's important. But secondly, you also have to say to her, you've got to do something about it. And I think, look, quite frankly, nagging never works. But in this case, you got to really hammer this home with her because she turns to you, or at least you become aware of these kinds of things, and she has to begin to become an active agent in changing it.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
Well, then you have to translate your agreement into some action with regard to that. Now, look, there's not going to be an easy answer. And let me say to everyone listening, there's no one cause to complex behavior. So there are a lot of different issues that are involved, and they need to be dealt with one by one, maybe some of them simultaneously, but they need to start to be dealt with. Donna, we're going to have to leave it at that because we have to take a brief break. Call me back and let me know what's happening with this, but you got to take the first steps.
Good for you for doing them.
Thanks for the call, Donna. Our number is 1-877-698-3627. That's 1-877-NYU-DOCS. You're listening to The Psychiatry Show. I'm Dr. Michael Aronoff. My guest and friend, I keep on adding that because it's true, is Davia Temin. She is the chief executive of Temin & Company here in New York City. She serves as a spokesperson for major organizations during crisis, coaches numerous global CEOs, is a frequent and popular public speaker, as I've said before, and advises worldwide corporations on the strategic direction of their women's councils. We're going to talk more about harassment and women and men. And by the way, harassment can go in both directions, although it's much more likely that a woman is harassed in a work situation. But there are other situations as well. School situations, work situations, the hospital here, whatever. I don't know of any particular case here, but, you know, I want to just open up.
I'm sure they exist.
Yeah, but they do exist. In any case, so we're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we'll continue the discussion on this first hour of The Psychiatry Show here on Sirius XM 110.
This is Dr. Radio, Sirius XM 110, and on the Sirius XM app. From the lobby of the NYU Langone Medical Center, this is Dr. Radio.
You like the music, huh?
I like the music. Thank you.
You get it? Well, we'll leave that as a puzzle for you.
It's my birthday.
Right. I mentioned in the beginning, it's Davia's birthday today. And we're talking with Davia Temin about harassment, gaslighting. We need to talk about gaslighting a little bit as one of the techniques that is often used by abusers. Not just abusers, but people, it's used by demagogues, it's used by a lot of people to avoid responsibility for their own behaviors, but we'll talk about that. So we're talking about harassment. We're talking about harassment, primarily sexual harassment. It can happen in any kind of circumstance. It has to do with power differentials and so forth. So I want to go right back to the phones and talk to Randolph, who has observation, Randolph from Oregon, about power issues in harassment cases. Randolph, you're on the air.
Well, good, and happy birthday, Davia.
Thank you.
Yes, the next Beatles song that you'll get familiar with years from now is When I Get Older.
Yeah, no comment on that one, Randall.
Yeah, you sound young and wonderful on the radio.
Yeah.
I'm calling as a concerned dad. I've got two smart, talented, beautiful young daughters, 113, 123, and they're both going up, participating in institutions that have that huge power differential between the good old boys at the top and the young women coming in. And, of course, we're seeing things exposed in the military and entertainment and politics. And my younger daughter is 13 in the gymnastics world, and they're taking care of that problem really well. I mean, we're getting they're taking, like you mentioned, the bystander training. They're getting that. So good things happening in the gymnastics world, but my 23-year-old daughter is a medical student, second-year medical school, and there's been, like, no big stories about abuses of the power in the medical establishment. Yeah. Is it because there's good self-policing going on, or I'm just naive?
No, that's not the reason why it's not good. It's because of a lack of attention to the issue, which can happen in any human interaction. It's why in the introduction I mentioned the different, you know, the classroom situation, the work situation, the laboratory, the scientific laboratory situation, in any kind of situation where there can be either a power differential or a perceived power differential. There can be abuses depending on the person who's the abuser and the responses of the abused, you know, in terms of their personality issues too.
Well, I'm gonna even go further than that, because I think that in, again, for medical school, in places where that are perceived as being exclusive, hard to get into, hard to move around if you don't have the recommendations of people who are influential and important. You know, getting into medical school is no easy thing. That she got in is wonderful. But once she's there, then she wants to stay there. And people do abuse power, and they abuse it horribly. And there is one other thing that is absolutely true, and I've seen it again and again, both in my work, that when a woman will report something that has been wrongly done to them or said to them or pressure put to bear to sleep with them, to get ahead, any of that, when they report it, sometimes even after the guy has just done it, he tries to get her fired or he tries to get her out there, because her existence is a reminder to him that this is what happened. And these kinds of things, when you are dependent upon the recommendations of people who are important, this is very hard to call out.
Let me even broaden it beyond that, Davia, because the situation of harassment, and this can happen within the same gender as well, in hierarchies where there is a power differential, where there's competition and so forth, one person higher up can utilize that power differential in some way to harass somebody beneath him that he feels threatened by, doesn't like, for whatever reason. So in any human interaction, this is possible.
It's possible, but it is stark. It is absolutely stark around sexual harassment. And let me give you a few pointers for what works, and it works within organizations, within colleges and universities as well, and in other institutions also. The first thing that you'd want her to do is to talk to her friends about it the minute that anything like this happens, because often it is that that testimony in some kind of adjudication hearing that people rely on. They say, well, did she tell anybody about it? Well, she told you about it. That's number one. She's told other family members, perhaps, other friends, a boyfriend, whomever. So that is number one. Number two, what you start to try to do is identify those people who you feel safe within the school, other faculty members, other consulting physicians, etc., who she might feel safe talking to, saying, I have a problem, I don't know what to do about it, I want to do the right thing, I want to guard my position in my class and you know, as a top student, but I need to figure out how to do this. What can you recommend? So she starts to widen the circle of people who know about it. And in this day and age, that is very important, because instead of keeping it a deep, dark secret, which, by the way, enables abusers to continue to do that, enables harassers to be able to continue that, she starts to shed some light on it. And then by getting in more people who she trusts into trying to figure this out. At that point, you figure out what kind of a complaint has had the best response in the past. Is this making sense?
Boy, it sure is. Thanks very much. I'm furiously writing it down.
Well, you know what? I'm going to slow Davia down so that you can remember. But there's, I want to broaden this a little bit as well. In corporate structures, there is what is called HR, human relations, and that is. Who does HR work for?
No. Because let me tell you something. You know, I hear this from people who've been victimized. Oh, well, I went to HR and they never came back to me. Or they lied to me or whatever else. Victims often believe that HR is on their side automatically and is there to
You're talking about the Human Relations Committee. Human Resources Committee.
Right, Human Resources. And there's generally a head of Human Resources, etc. But that human resources person is in a terrible bind, because that human resources person generally reports to the CEO or to the executive committee. And if the problem lies in the CEO or the executive committee, then they, and there have been many instances of this, then they are told, usually ignore this, don't do anything with it, or they don't even have to be told. They interpret it as such, or they believe it that way, or maybe they're somebody who believes in harassment as well. So going to an HR person is not necessarily the right thing. What I suggest that corporate boards do, boards of colleges and universities, all of it, is that they have a committee on risk and audit, and that there's a hotline for problems within the college or university or organization. And that hotline is taken, the calls are taken by an outside organization that then reports directly to the board. Not to management. Uh-huh. So it goes around management, because management can be wonderful and they can do everything that they can to do the right thing. And gosh knows there are lots and lots of HR heads who do that, but then they cannot as well.
I don't know that that model would necessarily hold in a hospital situation or a medical school situation, but yeah.
Yes, it would.
Well,
yes, it would.
How so?
Yes,
who would be the comparable?
You have a board of trustees of the hospital, of the college or university.
Well, that's asking a lot of Randolph's daughter to go to the board of trustees.
No. It goes to a hotline. But the hotline, what I'm saying is that structurally what works is if that hotline goes straight into the board.
If there is a hotline.
But, right. Now, if there is a hotline, it may not do that. It may go straight to somebody else who will do nothing about it. Uh-huh. That's why you want to ask all kinds of people what has worked before that you've known of when people have been in these situations.
Or at least to gather some supportive people around you that you have a larger volume of complaint.
A cohort.
Yeah, a cohort. Randolph, is that of help?
Great help. You've lessened the load of concern on this father's shoulders.
It's still of concern, but there's some possible angles at which to attack it, and that's what's important.
And you know what? The support of her father in this is so important for you to do this and for you to be behind her, and that's worth as much as can be. So that starts to empower her to not take it, and that's what you're empowering her to do.
Thank you for the call, Randolph. You are listening to Davia Temin, my friend and chief executive of Temin & Company. We are talking about crisis management in the various situations of harassment. Our number is 1-877-698-3627. That's 1-877-NYU-DOCS. I will have Davia here with us for the rest of this hour, so give us a call at 1-877-NYU-DOCS. I'm Dr. Michael Aronoff. Look, one of the things you're saying about gathering a cohort to support your exploration into a complaint, we mentioned gaslighting because that's one of the tactics that an abuser can use against the abused. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, denial is not just a river in Egypt, as they say.
Right.
And as we said earlier, the human ability to deny reality is huge. That's on the part of people who are having something go wrong in their lives. But it is also on the part of people who are doing wrong.
Right.
Right. And they will deny it when called on their behavior. They will deny it. And, you know, it's very effective.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, what gaslighting often refers to is a kind of psychological manipulation where the abuser does manipulation in order to question the abuser's sanity, his memory, his or her memory, his or her perceptions and so forth. And it's used not just by, you know, harassers. It's used in cults. It's used by dictators. It's used, as we've been talking about, by abusers.
That's right. And it's evil. And I think in no other way can I call it evil. Now, how do you then create your sense of reality and stick to your sense of reality when somebody says, I never did that. That's not true. I just patted you on the back. There was nothing else there about that. Well, the first thing is, again, you want to widen the circle of people you tell about it. So you want to talk about it right when it happens.
And you can often hear, oh, that happened to me too.
That's right. And then you start to see a pattern,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And probably with the same individual, I mean, that's one of the most powerful things. And that has actually happened to me myself when I finally said something, because, it, you know, it certainly at the beginning, you're shy. You don't want to say anything. You think it rebounds against you. And once you feel less shame on these things and you start to talk to others, you find they've been feeling the exact same thing.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
That's why, by the way, the internet and social media is empowering the Me Too movement like never before. Because these narratives, these personal narratives that we've all kept so close, and 81% of women say that they have been harassed or abused in some way sexually,
uh-huh.
right? So that these stories that we've had, we've kept to ourselves. Now, whether anonymous or by name, people put their names up there, they put their stories out there, and there's a certain triangulation, say against Bill Cosby, say against Harvey Weinstein, say against many, many, many others. And people start to say, he did that to you? Yeah, he did it to me. He said those same words. Larry Nassar, whatever it could be.
Yeah.
He did that same thing. Yeah. So this is allowing the outing of these abusers. And you know what? They can't gaslight as much, because it's really hard to gaslight 8 people who are saying that you did,
rather
not
than
just one.
Right, right. Let's go back to the phones to Jennifer from New York. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
In my senior year of college, I had 2 unfortunate situations. One was the, not the president of the university, but the second in command.
Mm-hmm.
And under the guise of wanting to help me study, he said, I'll meet you at the library, and then tried 50 times to get me to go to this faculty office building.
Mm.
And so finally what worked is he's like, this is hurting my throat to whisper. And he actually
poor baby.
Yeah, he actually used the word. He said, the library really isn't conducive to studying. I want to be able to, use the board. So we went there, and he proceeded to, touch under my shirt, on my, act like he was going to, he's like, you look stressed, and massage my shoulders. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I reported it, and he actually admitted to it, but he had no consequences. He continued on with his job, and he was actually at the university only about 6 months. There was no trial period or anything. One of the first women I told, she's like, that happened to my friend from him, too.
Yeah.
But no consequences, and he actually was promoted up through the system and is on to an esteemed position elsewhere. Second thing that happened also that year is I was an RA, and the resident director was inappropriate with me and someone else, and also was fired. Now he's on to teaching high school students. Both of these just bother me so much. One, that they can go on and have no problem, but also they're around more women.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just don't know. I have not done any social media where I say this. I've always felt bad that I'm certainly, I have my own issues, but he's exposing himself to other people too, and
sure,
they're running the risk. I doubt that he just changed his ways.
I'm sure he
didn't. What would you recommend I do?
Well, so can I just ask you, how long ago did this happen?
It was in 92.
Okay, so
haunting. It's haunting.
Well, yeah, and well, it would. We're talking about 26 years or so, uh-huh. right? So, first of all, guaranteed that at that time, people, it was wink, wink, nod, nod. They let this stuff happen. They let it happen in colleges and universities. And I work with a lot of colleges and universities now around these issues and other crises. They don't do it anymore, or at least most of them don't, and some of them still do, I will tell you. So here's where I would say to you, you can use the anonymous. You can use anonymous to your advantage. You don't necessarily have to use your name and your class and whatever else. But you can tell your story. You have to figure out in a computer way how you can do it on the college Facebook or in the college whatever, and or in the listserv or whatever, so that you are blinded out. And there are ways to do that. Just talk to an IT person.
Okay.
And tell your story. And make sure you can't be traced back, because I think that's, unless you want to be, but at the outset you may not want to be,
mm-hmm.
Because the people like this, who they could sue you. I mean, who knows what they could do? Because if they're evil, if they are irresponsible, once they'll be doing it again and again and again. But tell the story. Tell it. One of the ways that you're seeing a lot of these crises happen is that it starts with one, or maybe you send it to the college newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you do it with a, from an anonymous point of view. But you send it and say, I want to tell my story. Maybe you don't name the guy. Maybe you do. Depends. But some colleges and universities, the students will print that, or they'll put it on their web. And then other people hear it and other people hear it. And it starts to grow. This is the way, through narrative now, and narrative over social media and the internet, people are getting outed.
The only question I have about that, Davia, is if it's done anonymously, does that somehow undermine the validity? You know,
doesn't seem to be doing it as much, Michael, anymore.
Really?
No, it isn't, because then what's happened and what you see happening is other people read it, people start to talk
and
about
they
it,
respond.
And they respond with their names.
I see.
So I've seen situations where, let's say there were, I've represented situations where, let's say there were 9 people to whom it happened. 6 of them were anonymous, but 3 used their names.
Jennifer, we're going to have to cut you off because we're almost at the end of this hour, and I do have a couple of questions I want to.
I hope that helps.
Yeah, thank you for the call, Davia. What about we talked about the effect of sealing the records?
Yeah.
Since we're talking about, let's talk just briefly. We have about 2 minutes to talk about.
So one of the things that I think is the most enabling of harassers and abusers is the ability for them to seal their records, do a payoff, a big money payoff. The organization gives a big money payoff. Then the records are sealed, or there's a non-disclosure, and you never hear about it again. And what you find when you look deeply enough is that the same harassers have been doing it again and again and again and again. If they're star performers, if they're star people, if they're well-known people, it's been buried over and over and over again. They never get their comeuppance. They never get held accountable. So for a board of directors of a college or a university or of a company, I believe that it is morally important for them to demand to see every settlement that has ever been made around sexual harassment or abuse from the company, those that have been sealed, those that haven't been, and they need to look and see if there's a pattern on the part of some individuals who've done
this. But realistically, what's the uphill battle here? I mean, it's not so easy to get things unsealed. There's a real pressure.
But a board can know this. So, I mean, it's not generally sealed to the board. That's number one. And then they can double down on vigilance. But you need to know what the patterns are. And then you can, and then you don't, maybe you can't unseal it, but you can, going forward, use more vigilance.
We have about 2 minutes left. You've been listening to Davia Temin and me. I'm Dr. Michael Aronoff. We're talking about harassment, crisis management under these circumstances. Davia, can you leave us with a couple of tips about how to approach this kind of thing?
Yeah. Know that the world has shifted. Know that the internet and social media have changed everything. Now, individual people have a voice, a megaphone to the world. I believe it's each of our responsibilities to use this incredibly responsibly and honorably and with integrity. That means if you see abuses, out them, but you don't use it to hurt people when they have done nothing back. So you don't use it in a bad way, which some people are doing too.
But the other thing that you have emphasized a number of times throughout this hour is the importance of bystander participation with regard to that.
Good. Yeah. If you see something, if you see an abuse taking place, if you see harassment taking place, you do something about it. The best way to do it, first, take the guy away, almost physically, you know, deflect his attention, circle, get him on something else, circle back to the woman, make sure she's okay, and then report it.
As we who live in New York are well familiar with the slogan, if you see something, say something. It has a lot of value to us as a community. What we're talking about is a change in community standards that is more inclusive, that is in evolving in a very potentially productive way that we want to pay more attention to be aware of the vagaries of human behavior that can go awry, but of the responsibilities that we have as a human community to be there to rectify certain kinds of things. I want to thank my guest for this first hour, Davia Temin, for the wonderful, wonderful insight and participation in this discussion of harassment. Davia, obviously, we're going to have to do this again. A lot of interest and a lot of importance in terms of that. I want to thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
I will be back with you for the second hour. Those of you on the phone, hang in there. I will get to you when we come back and talk about all kinds of issues about, well, whatever's on your mind, including if there's a few hangovers from our discussion for this first hour. We'll be right back after this break.